This is a Pinball News production.
I'm not sure why he put chairs up here for us. I think when you get to be 90, you're supposed to sit down, but I'd rather stand up. But
and I'd rather sit down.
This old guy has to sit down, so I'll join him.
So, obviously, I don't have anything planned because this is a last-minute thing for me. I don't know if Wayne did or if we just want to open it up for questions and whatever, you know, anybody might have some interest or curiosity in. You know, feel free. Do we have any questions from anybody? Any stories that anybody wants to hear? All right, we're done.
I had a story I thought I'd tell, and I don't know. I'm pretty sure nobody's ever heard this story before. You know, it's hard to find a story that everybody hasn't heard before. We've been telling these stories here for the last 15 years, whatever, and they're all the same old stories and the same audience and we repeat ourselves and so on. But I thought I came up with a new one this time that nobody's ever told before, and I think it'll be a very interesting one. Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe up into the 60s, there were a lot of companies, coin-operated companies. There were Shuffle Alley, pinball, jukeboxes, and all this going on. And there were probably 15, 20 companies in the Chicago area either making something in the coin-operated field. So the manufacturers got together and decided to have an association, and they called it the CMI. Remember CMI?
Bill Gersh was around back then.
Yeah, and they were all active, and of course Dave, he was the president of the organization most of the time. He would get tired of being the president, and he would switch off, and he would. Get out of the job, and then he'd be happy for a year, and then right back, he'd elect him again, and so on. And so, like any other association, they had meetings every week or month or whatever, and then once a year, they would have a big deal going on, and they'd have a party down at the Sherman Hotel, and each company would have 10, 15, 20 tickets, and we'd get tickets, and we'd all go down and sit and have dinner, and listen to the speeches. And of course, Dave was usually the MC, and he ran the thing pretty much. And anytime you have an organization like that, they have to have a cause. And this cause, they finally figured out what they would give money to the Damon Runyon Cancer Fund. Now, Damon Runyon has been dead. He died in 1946. And he was a very prolific writer, if any of you know of him. And he used to write plays, and he write Broadway plays, books, one thing or another. And he was a very prolific guy. And anyway, he died from cancer in 46. And so the CMI decided they would put up some money. So every year, the manufacturers would come down there with their checks, and they'd give them $5,000 to Damon Runyon and $10,000, and this went on, and each manufacturer would go down the line and pay the money. So this went on for a few years, and it became the thing for the company to do. And you know that Damon Runyon Cancer Fund is still active. They're still collecting money and doing a lot of good work. Well, I thought this Damon Runyon was quite a character and an interesting guy, so I named a game after one of his stories. And I have a picture of the game in one of the brochures, and I signed it and wrote onto it that it was in honor of Damon Runyon. Now, I have that brochure signed and everything, and I'm going to give it to the first person who can tell me the name of that game that I made in honor of Damon Runyon. Pardon?
Paul Bunyan?
No. No. Does anybody know?
Did you only make one?
Oh, no. We made, I think there were 1,500 made. 1,500, and you'll be surprised that the number is that high when you know what the game is. You know, I thought that our friend, what's his name, knows everything.
Yep. I guess Sam's not here.
Sam. Sam would know, I think. But nobody knows. All right, well, I'll give you a clue, a couple of clues. It was made in 1953. What? I can't hear it.
Dragonette.
No.
And we have Guys and Dolls.
Guys and Dolls. Very good. How did you know that?
Well, I knew it was a flipperless game, and I kind of remember.
Yeah, it had no flippers, which is unusual. It had, it was kind of a cross between a nudgie. Anybody remember nudgie?
Okay.
Yeah, a couple people remember nudgie. And a flipper game. And we had a lot of trouble with it, but we did build 1,500 games. And I think that we never made another one. We made one and that was it. So, your turn. Well, anyway, I'll go on. What are you thinking? Dave was at the time. All manufacturers were shipping games like crazy. They'd get a new game come out, and they'd ship to each one of their distributors 50 games, 100 games, 200 games, and the poor distributors had to take them. And if they couldn't sell them, they started eating them. And you know what that does to a distributor? He becomes broke. No money, and Dave came up with the idea of gauge production and controlled distribution, and he promoted this at one of the banquets, and from then on we followed it. And I don't know about the other companies, but Dave Gottlieb would then ask each distributor at each game, how many do you want?
Right.
And if you want 50, that's what you got. If you wanted 30, you got 30. But you never, ever overloaded them. Now, when we started a game, he would call up each distributor, and he would ask them, how many games do you want? And when they gave him a list, they gave him a number, then that's what they got. And when we got near the end of production, then he would call them up again and ask them, how are you doing? Do you want some more games, or do you want to get rid of some games? If they needed games, we'd set them up and send them out. If they had too many games, he would transship to somebody who needed games. This made the distributors wealthy, and they became very good distributors and had money, and it was a wonderful thing. And that was followed all from that time on. We never made a game that we didn't have an order for. And that's why sometimes you'll see in serial numbers that there would be an odd number, like maybe 65, 865 games, or 1,515, or some such number. And that's because that's how many orders we had, and that's how many games we made. We never pushed a game onto an operator after that period of time. And that was back in the, I would say, late 40s, maybe early 50s.
And it stayed that way for another 10, 15
and
years.
And I think most of the companies picked that up, didn't they?
They did. I mean,
not like Gottlieb, though. Gottlieb, you know, in fact, Nate used to be our salesman. And I used to kid him. You know, I got away with murder with Gottlieb. I don't know. I was pretty close to all of them. And I would kid Nate, and every once in a while I'd tell him, you're just an order taker. You're no salesman. You're an order taker. And of course, he laughed. He said he knew it too, but that's the way it went, and that's what kept Gottlieb healthy, and our distributors healthy, and it was a good time for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, even when I started getting involved and getting more familiar with the business,
That was one of the things that I wound up learning early on. I remember hearing old stories, and maybe Wayne even remembers this. Valley didn't have really a strong track record in the early 50s. I mean, they had concentrated a lot on one ball games prior to the war, after the war, and had done some other stuff. And there's a gap, and I know that Jay probably is aware of that gap in terms of their pinball titles. But there was a period of time, as the story was told to me, that you'd have distributors or operators that would drive up, and this is when they were still on Belmont Avenue in the factory, the old factory, drive up with their trucks on a Tuesday, find out what the price was for the games that they were selling, leave, come back on Wednesday, and by Friday, maybe the price would be a lot better, and that's when they'd start buying them. So it wasn't a question of necessarily being first in line. It's a question of being basically last in line to get the best deal that you could get, so that they really didn't have any price stability. Compared to Gottlieb, they not only had price stability, but more importantly, had control over what they were producing. So if you see some things that are kind of like up and down in terms of either production runs or model releases back in the late 50s, early 60s, that was really one of the things that kind of hung Bally out to dry. It was only, you know, the real change for them was the emergence of solid state. There used to be a great ad campaign where Ava said that they tried harder. You know, they were number two. And for those who are old enough to remember that versus Hertz, Avis really was about number four or five, but through their advertising campaign and everything else, they had people believe that they were better than what they were. When Bally started in the mid-70s to change over to solid state, I want to say that they were number five out of four manufacturers. But that really kind of propelled them into a totally different realm. Yeah.
I'd add to that that was when Bally was getting very aggressive about buying distributors, so they had pretty much all factory branches.
All of Empire Distributing, right. Yeah. And Aladdin's Castles as well, which was an operation.
My territory is something out on the West Coast, so they could order people.
Yep.
Down to the distribution chain.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, again, back in the old days, I think it was much more of a friendly, competitive environment. I remember stories that Sam Ginsberg had told me when he was still heading up Chicago Coin. He kind of reminisced about 30s, 40s, and then after the war. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, if we needed parts or we needed something, just make a phone call, and down the street, you know, there'd be Gottlieb, or around the corner, there'd be Williams, and, yeah, we'd get some stuff or, you know, help each other out. Obviously, that's changed for those who have been around, not only for Gary's conversations, but probably more so from Jack's the last couple of days, that, it's a totally different environment now compared to when I first got involved in 74 and prior to that. So, the industry has kind of, morphed into something different than what it was.
Roger, the young man started in the business in 74.
Just being around it then, yeah, I was just a mere lad. I was about four or five, I think,
Steve
at the time.
Steve Kordick, he started in 36 when I started, same year I started.
Yep.
Yeah, he started, I think he started in the summertime sometime, August.
Yeah, coming in out of the rain, forest ranger person.
Came in out of the rain and ended up with a job.
Yeah, I mean, the part that I found fascinating, and hopefully Wayne will appreciate it, and I've talked about it before, was being able to meet all of the people who are behind the scenes. And you're talking to people who may have a couple of years on you, as they did, but we're talking about things that we both have mutual interest in, and I was curious and fascinated just about pinball and the industry and everything else, and you're able to kind of have a line of communication with somebody that, you wouldn't have otherwise. And those were wonderful times, they really were, with Wayne and Harry Williams and Steve and, Bill DeSelm and a whole slew of other guys that not only were designers, but some of the integral business people, and to see people who really kind of shaped and formed not only an entire industry, but an art form. The things that we're all celebrating and in love with, it's people like Wayne who provided that foundation through their creativity, their imagination over the years. So it really is a tribute to what it is that you guys have been able to do.
Did you have another story?
I can tell you another story.
Good. I was hoping you'd say
that. These stories, you know, it's hard to come up with a story that you haven't heard. And I.
Well, let me ask one thing first. How many people are here for the first time? Oh wow.
Okay.
Okay. Well, in that case, whatever Wayne, story. Right? Whatever Wayne thinks.
I got a million of them for you. Then.
There you go.
But this story is another story that's rather interesting. I always thought, but how many here remember the game Challenger? There was quite a few of you that remember that game. Well, you know, that game, I think we built 110 or 105, something like that, and I think we got back 200.
Yep.
Something in that line. But it was a terrible game, and it was designed by, I think, four or five or six of us. And, you know, a designer has to work alone. A designer can't work in a group. If you get a group together, you can't agree on anything. And anyway, there was Bob Smith and myself and Alvin and I don't know, Doc Arbark, our design, one of our mechanical men, and we all got together and were going to build this game, and we built Challenger and we shipped it out, and it was just terrible, and I think we got more back than we sold. But for those
who are not familiar with Challenger, it's an end-to-end two-player game, so it's a longer play field. If you're more familiar with Joust that Williams did some years back, it's the same kind of concept. There were some others. There was War back in the mid-70s that a small company tried to do as a solid-state game. So that was the premise of the game, and Alvin G and Company tried it again as one of their last games. So I just wanted to give you a reference point.
There you go.
What's he?
He's saying it's a great game. He has Challenger.
Oh, you like it?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I had one in my basement for a while, and my kids didn't play it. You know, they wouldn't play that game. But anyway, what I was going to tell you about that game. They like the game. Well, all right. I got rid of it in a hurry, as I recall. Maybe it was because I didn't like it. But anyway, it was a difficult game. And one of the things that was wrong with the game, basically, that we didn't see as a designer, we didn't recognize the fact that it took two to play. Now, anytime you have two to play, that cuts your percentage down in half, because one person... probably more than half, because one person likes to play a pinball machine, and they get into the game. They play the game and they're involved. But when you got two players, you're kibitzing back and forth, and you're not controlling. You're not playing a game, and it's not pinball as such. But anyway, we had a terrible run out. Like I say, 100. I think we made 105, 110, and they were all problems. So. Three, four, five, 6 months after we stopped production on it, if you can call it production, a guy came in from Canada. Now we were all sitting in Dave's office this particular morning, myself and Smith and Tony Gerard and all the rest, and we were having a big discussion about something. And Dave's phone rings, and here was a guy wanting to buy some games. So he came, so they, anyone who wants to buy games, well, you let them in the door in a hurry. And so this guy came in and introduced himself, and of course, we were all sitting there, and we weren't going to get up and go walk out. And we're sitting, and he says, I'd like to buy some games. And Dave says, well, what is it you want? He says, I'd like to buy some Challengers. And Dave says, how many you want? And he says, I'd like to buy 200. And Dave says, you don't want 200 of those games. You're going to go broke. They're no good. And he kept trying to talk him out of buying that game. And, of course, all of us sitting there, we were all laughing and carrying on and kidding him. And said, oh, don't buy that game. And he said, you know, I know my territory. And I know that they'll play the game. And he was from Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan,
okay,
Canada, and Northwest Canada, And he said, I know my people, and they'll play that game, and I want the game, and I'll pay for it. And Dave said, okay, you write me a check for 200 games, and I'll build them for you. But he said, don't say I didn't warn you that you're going to go broke. And we all agreed. You couldn't possibly make it. And the guy said, no, I know my territory. And he paid Dave the money in advance for 200 games. We built the 200 games and shipped them up to Canada. And, you know, we heard a couple months later, he went broke. And that, you know, it's amazing. Some people can't take advice. And he knew more than we did. And we were in the business. And we felt sorry for the guy. But you know, we all talked about it after that for a long, long time about, yes, sir.
I talked to Steve Young of Pinball Resource, specifically about the Challenger, because I think he gets that advice to restore mine. And Steve said that following the debacle of the Challenger, Mr. Donnelly ordered that all the unique parts for Challenger, which included extra wide lockdown bars and then the big top.
Yeah.
Display with the vertical. He ordered all those parts destroyed, the manufacturing property. Oh, $1 million, is that correct?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised, yeah. Yeah, we destroyed everything, because the game was so bad. Yeah. Now, I have a couple of brochures here from this gentleman, the House of Coin, SASK Limited, at 312 First Avenue South in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And I got a couple of them here. If anybody wants them, they're welcome to. Okay, there you go.
I think you have to add that to your game now.
I should have made more of them. Maybe if more people want them, I'm sure you can run them off here at the hotel. I should have run off a whole bunch of them, but I didn't know if anybody would be interested in them.
I understand. There's always surprises at Pinball Expo. So do we have any questions? Yeah, Mr. Guys and Dolls. Right. I'll share what I know, and he's asking about Bill Gersh. Bill was just a remarkable figure. Started with Billboard, created Cashbox. He was kind of a gruff old guy. I mean, when I met him, and there's a picture in my book, and I think that the picture really captures just his overall personality. He had started a publication. They actually, for those who are familiar with the industry, you have major trade magazines. There's Vending Times. The Tiny Weintraub started back in the 40s. You had Cashbox and Billboard, and Billboard stopped covering coin-operated amusement games back around the 60s, 70s, and Cashbox wound up doing it really as an add-on toward the back part of their magazine. In 1975, an operator in New Orleans by the name of Ralph Lally started up Playmeter. Eddie Adlam had been at Cashbox with Bill Gersh and wound up starting up a publication called Replay, which is still around. And kind of Bill divested himself, retired down to Florida, and started up I'll call it a magazine. It really wasn't, but it was called Marketplace. And Bill had these remarkable old photos that he would take at all the trade shows, and it was kind of like a newslettery type of, I mean, Pin Game Journal, in all honesty, has much better production values than what Bill was creating and producing for everybody. The joke used to be that you'd have a picture of somebody, and if Bill didn't know who the person was in the picture, he'd name a list of people and their friend. You know this guy, I don't have to tell you who it is, along with these people. But Bill really was an instigator. You know, Wayne was talking about the beginning of CMI, Bill really thought that there needed to be an association. You know, after World War II, things were a little bit tougher. You had some manufacturers that were falling out of the business. I mean, they had literally been out of work, if you will, doing their core business for a period of years. So you didn't have a lot of companies that were still remaining. He thought that, you know, there needed to be an association. I think back then it was the old Blackstone Hotel or the Sherman House.
Sherman House.
Which
the Sherman House had many stories.
Oh, and I've heard any number of them. Most of them are not repeatable. Very opinionated, very outspoken. You know, he was somebody that the industry really needed as a voice. And he didn't, you know, the problem that you have, depending on whatever business or industry any of you might be in, whatever trade publications exist, there's a fine line. And that fine line is you don't want to turn off your advertisers. So if you're going to write editorials or whatever else, it's got to be somewhat good. And the majority of trade publications, I don't care if it's electronics, engineering, manufacturing of some sort, whatever the category is, a lot of what you wind up getting are either opinion pieces that are written by the various companies, or you're getting reproductions effectively of whatever the press releases are. And I know that for a fact because I used to do all that stuff for Williams Bally Midway for about 12 and a half years. And I think that, you know, Bill provided a voice that everybody needed to really listen to, right or wrong, and that was his personality. It was, you know, kind of Bill's way or not the way. But retired to North Miami Beach Gardens and had an amazing amount of stuff. I remember meeting with him. I came in. The old offices of Cashbox were on Wabash Avenue in downtown Chicago, right north of Lake Street. So if you're near the river, it was a couple of blocks in. And Bill approached me to take over Marketplace. I got my list. I got all these names. I got all my photographs. You know, I can't do it anymore. You can do it. And we talked about it for a while, and I was still at GQ at the time, and it was like, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And Eddie Adlin and I had talked about it as well, and I think Bill maintained Marketplace. I have all the issues. I think he maintained it probably for another few years and then just finally, you know, kind of had enough. So I don't know if that answers what you're looking for, but really a remarkable guy. And I think to the point that I had said before, everybody had such distinctive personalities. I mean, the thing that I fell in love with when I kind of came much more involved in the industry, not only the games, but the people behind it and the sheer unadulterated passion that all of them had for what it was that they were doing. And you see it now with the next generation. If you sat in last night, you know, with what Greg and Dennis have done as a passion project with Woe Nelly and taking a Continental Cafe and, you know, modifying it, but trying to keep true to the integrity of the design and the era. You know, it's one thing to think of it as in quotes, big business. And you wind up getting a lot of that from, you know, from Jack or from Gary. But, you know, deep down in their heart of hearts, it's something that is ingrained. And I think that for people like Wayne and everything else, it wasn't a job. I mean, you loved what you were doing. There was always something new and different that you could do for the next thing.
It was a fun job.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that added to my longevity.
Yep.
You know, it's, you know, if you're happy and go lucky and you live, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Lawler made a comment, I think it was at a pinball expo a number of years back, that he had actually said to a member of the media, and I used to have a lot of press people coming into Williams doing interviews. We had TV cameras that were coming in to capture stuff, and I forget, whatever the man, it could have been Life or Smithsonian or one of those, but the person asked him, you know, so what do you think of when you're doing this, or, you know, why do you do this? And for those who don't know who Pat Lawler is, he's a game designer, very prolific, very inventive, successful, and kind of changed really the face of pinball back in the early 90s. But Pat, without even flinching, said, I design games for millions of people around the world that I will never meet. And when you think about that in the context of the universality of what it is that people like Wayne have created to really kind of capture the imagination of players from different places. And we see some of it here, you know, Harry coming in from Japan and people from Holland and such. It really is remarkable, the transcendent nature of pinball and the fact that it can appeal to people across all boundaries and barriers. So I tip my hat off, as I always do.
Thank you, Roger. How about some questions?
Yes.
Coin op industry, they make a lot of cash. Any involvement that you experience with one of my friends, right?
Now, it's funny, and again, you know, it's one of those things. let me relate a story, and I'll try not to be too long-winded here. But at GQ, I wound up doing a piece on health spas. And first one I went down to was a place called Palm Air in Florida. And it wasn't like I was overweight or anything else. It just seemed like, God, you get massages, there's exercise. I mean, it's all sorts of healthy stuff. What a great vacation option. And the piece that I did really resonated. This is like 75, 76. And I decided, let me do others. And there was a place called La Costa in Southern California. It's outside San Diego. And when I got there, and I'm coming from GQ, all right? I mean, it's GQ. When I got there, Penthouse Magazine had just hit the newsstands, and in Penthouse Magazine, they had an expose on the mafia having funded La Costa. And it was like, am I here for that? I'm from GQ. No. So, you know, whatever was going on in that field, and I just use that as a reference point. When I first started wanting to do this piece that I did for GQ, which led to the book and a piece in the New York Times, that was always on everybody's mind. And it was interesting. In digging through research and microfiche and what have you, and files, meeting people like Wayne and others who are around from the beginning of time, looking at movies like Bullets and Ballots, which had Edward G. Robinson and James Cagney running numbers and running pin games, the thing I used to say was, it absolutely is a family business, but it's a small F. From the manufacturing side of things, no. From the street side of things, locations, I have personal stories that I won't share. That was, I think that was up to whatever the city or the town or the region that you were in, and it had to do, it wasn't just pinball machines, it's vending equipment, it's cigarette running from the south where you're not paying taxes and coming up into the northeast and, you know, going elsewhere. But I think that the one thing that I tried to really make very clear in any of the press that I did to support the book was the fact that, no, this is people building in their garage in 1929, 1930, you know, an entire family kind of pounding nails into pieces of wood, and having a number of young, intelligent men wanting to get involved in any kind of work around the Depression. You know, the great story that Harry Williams shared with me was that he fancied himself to be a Disney animator. And there was no work back then, and there was some guy that was out in Los Angeles area. And I guess, as he said to me, it was a large hall, totally filled, and this guy had an old pin game. And he said, you know, he was looking for somebody to, you know, basically operate and distribute the games. And Harry jumped up, from what he told me, ran to the front, and he said, I'll take Los Angeles. And that's how he started. He started as basically a distributor for Bally in those days, when Bally was first starting up in the business. And Bally had started as a distributor for Gottlieb, and I guess David and the factory couldn't supply games fast enough for what the demand was back in 31. And he said, all right, I can build these myself. So no, I would say that it's always been a clean industry other than that other part. Would you clarify?
I'll go with that, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, Kerry?
Stop people from doing labels, sticking coat hangers into pieces, you know, in 3D
What people did to cheat?
Yeah, or how, and how to stop them.
Well, was it? Well, that's what the armor is on the side of the cabinet to keep your keep drilling a little hole in there and sticking a wire into the playboard, you know. But on some of these cabinets, you know, we used to put speckle, silver speckle,
right,
on the side, and they'd come along and drill a tiny hole right at that silver spot, and you'd never see it. And they'd come along with a wire and shove the wire in, move it around, run up free plays, short the game out sometimes, make a service call because they blow a fuse or something, but that's very common. And then, of course, with the free play unit, we always put a guard on the side of the free play unit where in the light box where they drill a hole through the light box and reach in with a wire and move the free play unit up or down, you know. And
that piece of metal was there just to stop people from shooting.
That's all. That's what it was. Yeah. That's what that guard was for. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Jack?
So the question is about Jack Guarnieri. Jersey Jack is starting up a pinball company. And the question is, you know, what do you feel about that and the fact that the theme that he is doing is Wizard of Oz, which is obviously a movie from 1939.
You know, that's so far back. Who cares? You know, they could copy anything and everything. I don't care.
Yeah. Did you ever want to do anything that might have been a licensed theme, like celebrity?
Well, no, I don't like licensing. I think it's a crime. What was this big guy, this basketball player?
Shaquille O'Neal.
O'Neal, yeah. Here the guy's a billionaire, and he charges our little business an exorbitant fee to put his picture on the glass.
Right.
What does he need it for? Why don't they let the, if, you know, why don't he use his name, let his name get out there and get known. But he don't have to take, every time he takes a quarter goes in the game, probably a penny goes to Shaq O'Neal. And that just bothers me. And I wouldn't pay one penny for that. I don't think it's necessary. Artwork is important in a pin game to attract people over. But once they start playing the game, artwork goes out the window, and I know this may rub the wrong way with a lot of artists and people who like the artwork, but as far as I'm concerned, artwork is only to bring them over to the game the first time, and then from then on, the game features themselves and the action on the board has got to hold the people there, and that's my theory, and I've told Stern that many times.
Yep.
But he asked me about these wild games they're building today. Why don't more people buy them? Well, who can play the games today? Only young people. People my age can't play them, that's for sure. I could play my game. I love to play my Spirit of 76, which I still have. And I don't know how many people heard that story.
It's a great game.
I'll tell that story about Spirit of 76.
Please.
You know, 1976 was our bicentennial year. And this country celebrated 200 years in existence. And so for two or three years before 76, I was thinking of that year, and we were going to build a game red, white, and blue and just splash it all over everything, and all flags flying and the band playing and all this big game, you know. So I worked along with Krinsky, and we built this game, and then we made it red, white, and blue, and we made some terrific features on the game. And if you ever played that game, you know it's a fantastic game. It's as good as any game on the market or ever was on the market. And so that came time to release the game for the first time, and Judd Weinberg and myself and Alvin and three or four of our top echelon people were sitting around the lunch table discussing the amount of games we're going to build. And so then J. judge says, well, let's see, how many are we going to build? And he says, this guy and this guy, each one is guessing, you know, 3,500, 2,500, 2,000, 1,800, you know, and going on. And I don't say anything. And he said, Wayne, how come you're not saying anything? You always got your mouth open saying something. And I said, well, I said, if I told you how many we're going to build, you'd just laugh, and I don't want to embarrass these other guys, you know. And he said, well, how many do you think? I said, 10,000. And of course, everybody, very funny. So he said, Wayne, I tell you, if we build 10,000 games, the 10,000 game is yours, and I'm going to deliver it to your house and set it up for you. Now, you got a deal, and I got the 10,000 game. I still got that game. And I play it frequently, I have a little piece of paper on the top arch with the top scores and list it down, and I'm on the top. And you know, Michael Shalhoub, I think a lot of people know Michael Shalhoub here?
From Australia, he's written a number of books.
Does anybody know him? Good. Well, you know, Michael, he's a great gentleman and a fine friend, and he came down to Arkansas and visited me. And he played on that game, and he was going to beat that score. Well, he hasn't beaten it. I think he beat me one time, and then I topped him, and I'm on the top. And I told him, now you got to come back, Michael. You got to come back and play some more. And I hope he does someday. But he's a real competitor. And I can tell you another story about Michael. We got the time to do it?
Yeah. I'm going to interject one time before we change subjects. Hold on to the thought. First time I went to Europe, and it was to work on my pinball book with James Hamilton. Got to England. First game I ever played. And I wanted to make sure that it was going to be something special. It was Spirit of 76. The amazing thing was that the back glass was broken. But that was the first game in Europe, in all my travels, that I ever played, and loved it. And they did a second version, two-player Pioneer. And they also did it as New York, which is a special limited edition they did just for New York to help celebrate the bicentennial. But to Wayne's credit, an incredible game, very challenging, great rule set, and. So, Michael Shalhoub story.
Michael, when he was visiting me, we talked and were having a great time, and he kind of ribbed me and chided me a little bit about us here in this country, how we drive on the wrong side of the road, and our light switches are reverse and all these kind of things, you know. And so after he left, I got thinking about him a little bit, and I was thinking, you know, I'm going to put a circuit in that game, and I'm going to reverse the flippers on him. And so I got a relay and got the wiring, put it together, and put it in my game and tried it out. And I set it on the fourth player. Whenever your fourth player would come up, the flippers would be reversed. So I bring it up to the show last year, and I put it on Spirit of 76, and it was on Phoebe's 76, and so we set it up with Michael to come in and play that game, and he brought his sidekick along from Australia, and I had Phoebe and myself, and so I said, all right, well, ladies first, we'll have a game, and the loser has to buy dinner. And he's okay, because he was sure he could beat us, you know. After all, I had a woman and a Wayne, you know. There's the two soft ones here. We got a free dinner coming up. So we started to play, and I said, all right, ladies first. So Phoebe went first, and his buddy went second, and I went third, and then Michael played. Well, us three played, and we got average scores. And everything was fine, and then Michael comes up and he shoots. Of course, he walks up there confidently, and he shoots that ball, and it comes down, and he flips it, and the wrong flipper. And he looked at it; he couldn't believe it. He flipped the wrong one, you know. So he steps back, and he just couldn't believe it, you know. And of course, we're all laughing, and he don't know what we're laughing about. So then comes the next ball, and then we shoot again. Of course, we're shooting average scores, and now he comes his turn, and he walks up to it, and he pushed the flipper button, and the wrong one went, and he couldn't believe it. He just couldn't believe it. So then he shot, and of course the ball ran out. He couldn't his mind, well, I've tried many times, and my mind will not translate from my right mind to my left hand. It just won't work. And so he played anyway. He lost, but he never took us to dinner. So I talked to him the other day. He called me up and they said he wasn't coming up this year, and so he was ill and so on. And I said, Michael, you still owe us dinner, and we're not going to let you forget it. So when you're due, when you come up here, you're buying dinner for Phoebe and I. So, but it was a lot of fun, and now I left. Phoebe still has the relay, and she puts it in. I don't know what game she's got it in, but I know she still has it in games. And,
I remember playing it last year.
You played it last year?
Okay. Well, yeah. I tried to play it last year.
You can't play it.
No.
Your mind cannot tell your right hand to transfer that information to your left hand. It just won't work.
Well, in that game, for those who are somewhat familiar with it, I mean, the action is pretty intense when it comes down to the flipper. You got
pretty much, you know, wide open play field. You got two target banks. You got a center hole, which is a bitch with the metal behind it. So, I mean, it's coming down, and your first reaction, yes, it's going to come to the right. Okay, nope. And, yeah.
Well, that center hole scores the bonus, and it scores double bonus on the last ball.
And
if it's already
too.
On double, it's double-double. And I've never, and I've played the game a lot of times, and I've never caught double-double. Never.
Yeah.
It's there. It's out in front, and you see it, and you know it, and you got to play it, and you keep trying, and you can't do it, and you're going to put another quarter in, and you're going to play. That game is sensational. It's almost as good as Queen of Hearts. Almost.
There you go.
My favorite game.
The man on the left side of the room over there a few minutes ago asked about the mobbing and golf. He's been here about a few years ago. Elton got me told the story. He's driving along.
I'll also share something really quickly, and Doc, I won't leave you out. A number of years back, I had an idea. I wanted to do a trivia book. And I wanted to do a trivia book based on pinball content, and I had a relationship with Bantam Books. And I wanted to do a trivia book. We were going to give away an arcade room full of games, and it was going to be a tie-in with Bally. So it was going to be video games, pinball machines, you name it. And my idea was that we would then sell the answer book. So we're going pretty much far along, and I'm dealing with one of the top editors at Bantam Books. Billy O'Donnell was still there, along with his dad, Bill O'Donnell, who was heading up the company. Tom Neiman, names that you may or may not have some familiarity with, and so on. And they were behind me. I mean, thought it was a great idea, thought it was a good promotional tool. It was in advance of the 50th anniversary for the company. And just remember, we got to some point, and the editor said, you know what, and I did a whole proposal for it, did a layout of, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 pages. And they said to me, you know what, we're just not really comfortable, you know, doing anything with Bally. And I remember calling up Billy O'Donnell and telling him, you know what, Bantam doesn't want to do it. You know, he has some problems. And Billy's first reaction, who do I call? Who do I talk to? Let me get on the phone. I fly out, meet with him. I said, that's the worst thing that you can do. No. So to the same point in terms of, you know, Alvin's story and relaying that, yeah, I guess there is still some of that mystique misplaced. Doc?
No, there was never a hidden number that I know of. They put some in that you needed a black light to see, if that's what you mean. Yeah, they put it on with I don't know what it is, but it's some kind of a little clear paint, and you needed a black light, and you read the number. Yeah, they did that for a while when they were bootlegging. There was a lot of bootlegging going on. But once they started this controlled distribution, that bootlegging stopped. They kept pretty good control over that.
You know, a time frame around that period was black light, what year was it?
Oh, I can't remember, no.
Yeah. And I can't help on that either.
No.
As a way of trying to get you to speak to something new, do you have any stories involving fire all your career?
Pardon?
Fire.
Fire?
Yeah, any stories about fire? Fire?
Fire.
In,
like
machines that have burned up or whatever else, maybe shorted out, maybe had some fires or whatever.
Well, I think it was Gottlieb. I think it was Gottlieb. I was working at Western at the time. I don't remember which company was which. I remember. But they built a game called Fire Alarm.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
No, I remember Fire from Williams.
Fire Alarm.
Okay.
And it was down at the convention, and it was on the floor of the convention, and the fire alarm caught on fire. And of course, they never heard the end of that. I think it was a Gottlieb game, and I was working for Western at the time. I went to those conventions from the time I was 17 years old. And I tell you, I learned a lot. And it wasn't all about pinball machines. Because most of you heard about the Sherman Hotel. It was kind of a wild place. But I can tell you a real quick story. I was 17, or maybe I was 18 at the time, I'm not sure just how many months was involved in there. But we had a game, Jimmy had a game that he was going to give away at the show. And so he had the game up in the room. Everybody, all the manufacturers had a room up in the hotel. And down on the floor, they enticed the different people to come up in the room, and there they'd give them the old sales pitch, you see. So Jimmy had the idea of putting these keys, a big barrel of keys, in front of his booth. And you come by, you're supposed to pick out a key and then go up to the room and try it in the game. And if your key fit, you won the game, you know, which is the old come on game. I've played many ways, I'm sure. Anyway, my job, Jimmy gave me the job of standing alongside of that game. And he says, now, if anybody comes along with a key that opens that door, you yell for the police, because the only key to that door is in my pocket. And that was my job. I stood there for 3 days watching that door. That nobody, no key would fit that door. And all these people coming up and trying that lock. And of course, we took the game back to the factory at the end of the convention. But those were days when things were a little wild.
Sure. Yeah,
Tom? When we were talking about the licensing earlier, I always thought the Continental Cafe, that was supposed to be Elvis in the Continental Cafe.
He's saying that he thought the Continental Cafe was supposed to be Elvis as a theme.
Elvis?
Yeah, as a theme.
No. No, no, it wasn't, no, not intentionally it wasn't, no. Not intentionally.
And Mayfair being My Fair Lady?
Oh, sure, that was a copy of it. We used to, you know, it's amazing how we used to copy everything, and there was no lawsuits. Nobody thought of lawsuits back in those days.
Oh, the ice stones.
Pardon?
The ice stones, that's, you license that, you just use that.
Guys and dogs.
Just use it, yeah. We never got licenses for anything.
I mean, licensing, if you really think about it, Star Wars back in around, 76, 77 was when things really started happening. There had been some branded, items. Most of it was apparel. You'd have somebody's name on the butt of your jeans back in that time frame. But you didn't have the same proliferation of, of branding, whether it's food products, fashion, games, or anything else. So it's somewhat of a new phenomenon, and the person responsible for it, at least for pinball, back in the mid to late 70s was Tom Neiman at Bally. And again, you have an introduction by a company that hadn't really been a factor, hadn't been really competitive, not only coming out with some new technology, with Solid State, but suddenly he had things like Wizard, Captain Fantastic, Rolling Stones, Kiss, and the list kind of goes on, which really propelled them to a position of strength. You know, Gottlieb was very late getting into the Solid State market with the Rockwell system. I know Alvin always blamed me because I always got on his case.
You what?
Alvin always blamed me because I always got on his case that you guys were so late getting into it. Told me that because I used to write about it in the trades, Playmeter,
well,
and all the rest of it.
You know, I've always taken responsibility for that. I don't know whether Alvin would say that or not, but
yeah.
I say it because I should have seen the light sooner. But I was too busy doing other things, and I didn't.
Yeah, but Cleopatra and Sinbad, which were the first two major releases, were, I think to this day, two of the most exceptional games.
We were way behind, and we had to work hard to catch up, and never did catch up.
No. So, yeah.
You said you were busy working on
He's saying that you were saying that you were busy working on other things, what had your attention, and I think it means, in terms of Solid State, whether or not you guys recognized.
We were building at that time probably 400 games a day.
Right.
And I was chief engineer at that time, and I was in charge of design, engineering, what was going on in the shop, everything was running smoothly, and so I was running pretty hard. I mean, we were building a game. You know, if you're building 400 games a day, and you only work 8 hours a day, and that's 480 minutes, and you take out 20 minutes for breaks, and, you're talking 450 minutes a day, and 400 games, you're turning the game out every minute, and we were going pretty good, and so I was busy, and I didn't see the light. I worked too hard.
I think the other part of it, you got to understand the time frame. You know, Gottlieb was really still number one. Williams was kind of floundering. Bally was kind of, flashy, if you will, with stuff. I don't think a lot of people really understood and were willing to accept the fact that Solid State was going to be the solution. You know, the first games that came out from Merco Games out of Arizona with their Spirit of 76, and the hybrid game that Allied Leisure came out with, Dynamite, didn't really say anything to anybody. The sounds were bad. The feel was bad. I remember going into, Wayne was talking before about a suite. I remember Steve Kordak grabbing me in the old Westin Hotel. I guess it's still around. The convention used to be at the Hilton downtown in Chicago. And he said, come on, let's go. I'm driving you. I want to show you something. I want to see what you think. And he had three Grand Prix lined up. And it was three different systems that they were considering using and wanted my input as to, what I thought was, the best one out of all of them. And, again, it was feel. You know, if you play an original, Bow and Arrow, which was the first run that they did a dual run at Bally, the Solid State is okay. I mean, the mechanical feel and sound was the part. So I'll take Wayne to task for the fact that they were late, but I don't think that anybody really believed it. And the sales pitch that was done, you have to understand, you have an industry where everybody was very comfortable doing what they were doing. You know, I'm soldering boards, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, it's Solid State, and I'm dealing with these, board sets and electronics. Bally had a guy by the name of Bernie Powers, and Bernie Powers, I think, probably spent about 800 days in the year and about 14 days per week going around to distributorships doing open houses. I remember going to one that they had in New York at their distributorship, and the place was packed, and guys were walking away. I said, please. The sales pitch with Solid State, we're going to make the games more reliable and they're going to be cheaper. Guess what? They weren't more reliable and they definitely weren't cheaper. So, there you go. I mean, there's an inevitability when you look at technology. But I think that to the point, and I said before in terms of the grief I gave them, I think that they probably waited, they being Gottlieb, probably waited maybe 6 to 9 months to get their act together. The part that I will say is, if you look at Hot Tip, which was the first game that really went into production as a Solid State game, versus Cleopatra, which was done as a dual run, the best system was the Gottlieb system. Flippers were good. I mean, everything was just really pristine with their first game. So they may have been late, but what they did was really the best, and everybody else needed to catch up. By then, though, a lot of the momentum was gathered by other companies that didn't have games that I thought were either designed as well or played as well. So I compliment you on having
you,
waited.
Thank you.
Williams was party to a patent infringement lawsuit regarding the design of the Clippers. I was wondering if you could just give us the chronology. Some people here probably haven't heard some of this. I know a little of it, but give us, please, the most complete story that you can.
Talking about the patent infringement on Flippers between Williams and, I guess, Gottlieb and whatever else, since Gottlieb was the premier Flipper maker. Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard of anything either, per se. Right. Yeah, I know that some of the construction coils and whatever else, yes, there were some things that went on. But again, back then, it was more of a friendly rivalry. I mean, it was different. You know, the companies weren't necessarily publicly held companies accountable to shareholders in Wall Street.
I was wondering how it was settled, though.
You know, Gottlieb never did patent that Flipper, which they should have done in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other matter.
Yep. They would have had it made. But they've never agreed on patents. In fact, I'm surprised I got a patent on my bumper switch. But that's the only patent I know of that they've taken. And what Dave always said, what's good for Gottlieb is good for the industry, and what's good for the industry is good for Gottlieb.
Right.
And that's the way he felt, and he didn't care whether they used it or not.
Yeah, I mean, the one that really started doing much more patenting in the mid to late 70s because of solid state and everything was Bally. And I know that with rollover switches that I had to take out in Sharpshooter 2. Because they were going after game plan and going after vendors to say, I'm going to cut off our business supply if you're doing work with these people. I mean, it got a little bit more cutthroat. To your point in terms of the Flippers, and from whatever my recollection is, I have a feeling that things just kind of settled on their own. I don't think there was anything financial or otherwise. So,
I don't think so either. I don't think Dave ever would go after somebody for money.
Right.
Well, he didn't need to. Dave had enough money.
Right. And I don't think that Lou Nicastro and all honesty.
Look at the hospital.
Gottlieb
built that hospital. I don't know if anyone's ever seen it over there, but it is tremendous.
We're talking about Gottlieb Memorial Hospital.
Before that, he did other things. He donated an awful lot of money to an old folks' home up in Evanston, I think it was.
Yep.
That he supported that old folks' home for years. And he was a very generous man.
Well, most of the people back then actually were. I mean, all the stories and the stories that can't be told in terms of parties and the other things was that it seems like all the founders...
donated a lot of money to that cancer fund.
Yeah, but all of them had a heart of gold. I remember hearing stories about Bill O'Donnell and the fact that if anybody was ever down and out, and Ray Maloney the same, just come in and give him a job. Yeah. You know, help him and do whatever they could. Anyway, Rob, I guess we've hit our time.
Guys, thank you so much for being here. Hopefully next year we'll get you back, huh?
I'm tired of sitting here. Now, how do I get up?